or as proof of the system's ultimate strength, the system that saved the world. Of course there had been excesses, the Stalinist pamphleteer Nina Andreeva once told me, but without collectivization we would have starved during the war, and without industrialization, where would the tanks have come from? Even as late as 1991, the military leadership held on to the habit of sponsoring official histories, and few projects were more important to the hierarchy than the writing of a new history of the war. This would be the third multi-volume official history of the great patriotic war since Stalin's death. But the Ministry of Defense, which was in charge of the project, knew that this time, several years into the Glasnost era, a completely bogus history was out of the question. The committee-written project would have to address the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and the purge of the officer corps in the late 30s. The new official history would have to answer the question why the Nazis were able to invade the Soviet Union in June 1941 with such ease. The man in charge of the first volume, tentatively titled On the Eve of the War, was General Dmitry Antonovich Volkogonov. Marshal Dmitry Yazov, the defense minister, Marshal Sergei Akromeyev, the leading military advisor to Gorbachev, General Valentin Varenikov, the commander of all ground forces, and the other hardliners at the top of the army, accepted Volkogonov as editor, knowing they would not get a warmed-over version of the old histories of the war. His biography of Stalin, Triumph and Tragedy, published with the encouragement of the Gorbachev leadership in 1988, was the first objective study not written by a dissident. As the director of the military's main history institute, he had had access to all the major archives of the party, the KGB, and the military, while they were still closed to almost everyone else. He was the logical man for the job. They were prepared for a history that was more critical than those published under Khrushchev and Brezhnev. But they were not prepared for what they got. In late 1990, Volkogonov's team turned in a draft that coolly assessed the relative evils of Stalin and Hitler and described in full detail the repressive command system which carried out, at Stalin's direct order, the wholesale slaughter of thousands of officers before the war. The draft explored the roots of Stalin's terror and its origins in the Red Terror that followed the revolution. They wrote critically of Stalin's negotiations with the Nazis that allowed Moscow to annex the Baltic states and other key territories. Most appalling of all to the hardliners, Volkogonov's draft concluded that the Soviet Union had won the war almost by chance, despite Stalin, not because of him. They implied that perhaps the death of 27 million Soviet people was in vain, that the victory of the Soviet Union represented the victory of one brutal regime over another. The Ministry of Defense sent copies of the draft history around to various reviewers, generals, admirals, officials in the Communist Party, and the heads of the major institutes. Their reaction was angry and quick. Akromeyev gave an interview to the reactionary military historical journal that accused Volkogonov of acting as a traitor. Had Volkogonov succeeded in publishing the work with its obviously false positions as set out in the first volume, it would have done great harm, and not only to history, Akromeyev said. The lies about the war would have been used for undermining the integrity of our country and the socialist choice, and for the constant defamation of the Communist Party. This could not be allowed. Volkogonov, he said, was an anti-communist turncoat serving just one master, the equally anti-communist Russian president, Boris Yeltsin. The denunciations had only just begun. On March 7th, at an elegant meeting hall in the Ministry of Defense, 57 generals, Central Committee officials, and official academics gathered to review Volkogonov's work. The chairman of the editorial committee, General A.F. Kochetov, opened the session by reminding everyone that when the original conception of the 10-volume work was discussed, everyone agreed with the idea that the driving force of the victory was the Soviet people, the People's Army, the toilers, all led by the party. But today, proceeding from the interests of the moment, everyone insults and blames the party. Suddenly the people are to blame. Many of the reviews ask the question, if things were so awful before the war, why did we win? Kochetov pointed out incredulously that in the book there was an implicit and intolerable comparison of socialism with fascism. He said that some of the reviewers had also complained that Volkogonov betrayed the intentions of the volume by discussing the origins of the system leading up to the war, and others simply objected to the titles of chapters, such as The Political Regime Grows Stricter and The Militarization of Spiritual Life. Kochetov then opened the session for general discussion, an invitation to a beheading. General Mikhail Moiseev, chief of the general staff, attacked Volkogonov, saying that he was merely out to inspire today's destructive forces, meaning Yeltsin and the pro-independence activists in the republics. "Defend the army," came the calls from the hall. Later, Valentin Falin, the head of the Central Committee's international department, took the floor. "We must point out the insufficiencies of this volume. It's thousands of mistakes," he said. "I have not seen such fantastical stuff in 30 or 40 years. To waste government money on this is out of the question." Volkogonov turned pale. He had grown away from these men, but he was only now aware by how much. After more than an hour of denunciations, he finally demanded the floor. "Respected comrades," Volkogonov began, "my voice in this hall will no doubt be a lonely one. There is not likely to be a real scholarly discussion here. This is a tribunal on scholarship, on history, on a large group of writers. Instead of an analysis of the issue, there is just unbridled criticism. In the atmosphere that has been created here, I cannot write a new history. To write only about the victory of 1945 means to talk nonsense about 1941, about the 4 million prisoners, about the retreat to the Volga. It is impossible to reduce history to politics." Volkogonov had only begun. But now Varenikov, one of the most reactionary generals in the Ministry of Defense hierarchy, broke in, shouting, "There is a suggestion to deny him the floor." Volkogonov refused to back down. "I am no less a patriot than Falin and love the motherland no less than he," he said. "But you cannot change the consequences of history. I agree with those who say there are many faults in this volume. But let's discuss and debate them. We'll give our points of view. But no, Comrade Falin and some others do not engage in scholarly debate, but rather make accusations about a lack of patriotism." "Enough," one general shouted. "Listen to this." Somewhere in the hall came the shout, "Stop his speech." Volkogonov kept going, arguing that unless the book and the Soviet people dealt with all the cruelty and misery that had preceded the war, there could be no understanding of what happened after the opening volleys of the Nazi invasion. How else can we look at the fact that 43,000 officers and other army officials were purged, he said. And what of the other victims? We don't need blind patriotism. We need the truth. Mine is a lonely voice in this hall, but I want to see what you say about it all in 10 years. The chairman was appalled. He took personal offense. Finally, the swarm overtook Volkogonov. The general shouted him down, and he did not speak again. But the ritual was far from over. 2.5 hours after the session had begun, Marshal Yazov, the Minister of Defense, arrived. Yazov, with his lumpy face and bulbous nose, was none too bright. When it came time to appoint a new defense minister after a German teenager, Matthias Rust, managed to land his little plane on Red Square in 1987, Gorbachev went way down the ladder and found Yazov, the chief of military operations in the Far East. The man had a reputation for mediocrity. But that was the point. Gorbachev wanted a man utterly without cunning. He wanted a pleasant mutt, a loyal friend. But that was years ago. And now, with the conservatives in the midst of a full-fledged counter-revolution against radical reform, Yazov was showing his strength. He despised the direction perestroika had taken. Hundreds of thousands of young men in the Baltic states, the Caucasus, and other regions were ignoring their draft notices. Gorbachev was cutting troop levels, and other liberals wanted even more reductions. Meanwhile, officers returning from Eastern Europe and Germany were living in crowded dormitories and even tents. Yazov quickly addressed the group, and there was no doubt that his anger went far beyond any rough draft or a three-star general named Volkogonov. The battle over the book represented to him nothing less than the overall struggle for power in the Soviet Union. The Democrats now have made it their goal to prepare and carry out a Nuremberg II on the Communist Party, Yazov said. The volume has in it the outlines for an indictment for such a trial. This book has, at its foundation, a libel of the party, Varenikov pitched in. In this hall, Yazov continued, I think everyone is a communist, and communists cannot spit on their party. It was over. Volkogonov was dismissed from the editorial committee, and his draft was returned to the board for fundamental reworking. Another victory for the hardline coalition. 5 months later, in August, Yazov, Varenikov, Moiseev, and other men in the room would go even farther and attempt a coup d'etat. I first met Volkogonov in 1988, when he was still in the official fold and about to publish his biography, Stalin, Triumph and Tragedy. The English translation did not appear until 1991. The publicity flacks around the foreign ministry were pitching him as their breakthrough historian, which caused immediate suspicion. For the liberal intelligentsia in Moscow and Leningrad, Volkogonov was not an inspiring choice. He had published dozens of books and monographs on military ideology, and none of them even hinted at independence, rigor, or critical thought. Here was a military man who had played the game. If he harbored dissident thoughts, he had not yet committed a whisper of them to paper. But at a meeting with journalists at the foreign ministry, Volkogonov was impressive. He spoke without bluff or euphemism. He was familiar with all the major Western scholarship on Stalin, making detailed and admiring references to a number of books, especially Robert C. Tucker's multi-volume Biography in Progress. As a way to defend himself against official party historians who would attack his use of foreign scholars, Volkogonov wrote in the introduction, "Without realizing it, Stalin did far more to blacken the name of socialism than anything written by Leonard Shapiro, Isaac Deutscher, Robert Tucker, or Robert Conquest." Volkogonov clearly had full access to the Spetskran, the special shelves of Soviet libraries where banned books were secreted away. In his bibliography, he cites books that were, until Glasnost, unavailable for ordinary Soviets. Adam Ulam's biography of Stalin, Deutscher's biography of Trotsky, Richard Pipes's Russia under the Old Regime, Mila Vangelis's Conversations with Stalin, and the memoirs of Stalin's daughter, Svetlana Aleluyeva. In addition, Volkogonov read and made reference to the works of Stalin's enemies, the men he defeated and executed. Bukharin, Trotsky, Rykov, Kamenev, Zinoviev, Tomsky. If Volkogonov had merely cribbed the Western biographies of Stalin and published the result under his name in the Soviet Union, his book would have had a certain notoriety. The mere notion of a Red Army general laying bare the awful facts of the Stalin era would have been an astonishing advance in the Soviet Union's attempt to recover its historical memory. But he did much more. Volkogonov will be remembered not so much as a great thinker or writer, but rather for the uniqueness of his access, the way he made scholarly use of his political position. Volkogonov alone had the chance to exploit the paperwork of the totalitarian regime, and he went everywhere. the Central Party Archives, the USSR Supreme Court Archives, the Central State Archives of the Army, the Ministry of Defense Archives, the Armed Forces General Staff Archives, and the archives of several important museums and institutes, including the Institute of Marxism-Leninism. On those shelves, Volkogonov found no definitive answers to the remaining riddles of history. For example, he did not come up with a smoking gun in the 1934 murder of the Leningrad party chief Sergei Kirov. Nearly all Western scholars assume, with good circumstantial reason, that Stalin ordered Kirov killed in order to eliminate a potential political threat and to set the stage for the Great Terror. Volkogonov assumed the same and wrote, "The archives that I have searched do not provide any further clues for making a more definitive statement on the Kirov affair. What is clear, however, is that the murder was not carried out on the orders of Trotsky, Zinoviev, or Kamenev, which was soon put out as the official version. Knowing what we now know about Stalin, it is certain that he had a hand in it. The removal of two or three layers of indirect witnesses bears his hallmark." But while triumph and tragedy made no sensational advances, while it did not solve the enigma of Stalin's motives or produce a definitive death toll for the repressions of the era, the book was in no sense a failure. By providing excerpts from hundreds of memos, telegrams, and orders that had never been seen by scholars before, Volkogonov allowed the reader a terrible intimacy with the Soviet despot. Triumph and tragedy gave new texture, at once horrifying and bland, to our knowledge of one of the worst passages in human history. In his portrayal of Stalin, Volkogonov was more critical than many of his liberal critics might have expected. Triumph and tragedy showed Stalin to have been a coward, a miserable commander-in-chief during the war, a mediocrity but not insignificant, as Trotsky once put it. Volkogonov provided the conclusive documentary evidence that Stalin, using blue or red pencils, personally ordered the deaths of thousands in the same offhand tone as a man ordering a drink at a bar. According to I.D. Perfilyev, an old Bolshevik who had spent many years in a concentration camp and who told me the story, once in Molotov's company, while discussing a routine list with secret police chief Nikolai Yezhov, Stalin muttered to no one in particular, "Who is going to remember all this riffraff in 10 or 20 years' time? No one. Who remembers the names now of the boyars Ivan the Terrible got rid of? No one. The people had to know he was getting rid of all his enemies. In the end, they all got what they deserved." "The people understand, Yosif Vissarionovich. They understand and they support you," Molotov replied automatically. In Moscow, I got to know Volkogonov fairly well, first in his incarnation as a military historian, then as a political outcast, and finally when he became a radical deputy in the Russian parliament in 1990 and a top military advisor to Russian President Yeltsin. Even early on, when he had to take great care in how and with whom he talked about his work, Volkogonov never concealed just how deeply his days in the archives had moved him. "I would come home from working in Stalin's archives, and I would be deeply shaken," Volkogonov told me. "I remember coming home after reading through the day of December 12, 1938. He signed 30 lists of death sentences that day, altogether about 5,000 people, including many he knew personally, his friends. This was before their trials, of course. This was no surprise. This is not what shook me. But it turned out that having signed these documents, he went to his personal theater very late that night and watched two movies, including Happy Guys, a popular comedy of the time. I simply could not understand how, after deciding the fate of several thousand lives, he could watch such a movie. But I was beginning to realize that morality plays no role for dictators. That's when I understood why my father was shot, why my mother died in exile, why millions of people died." Volkogonov was born in the Siberian city of Chita in 1928 and later moved to the Pacific coast of Russia. His father was an agrarian specialist, and his mother cared for the three children. In 1937, at the height of the purges, Anton Volkogonov was summoned to the local party committee, where he was arrested for the crime of possessing printed matter of a politically questionable origin, a pamphlet by the right deviationist Nikolai Bukharin. Volkogonov's father was never seen again. "He just disappeared into the meat grinder of the purges," Volkogonov said. "When I was older, my mother whispered to me, 'Your father was shot. Never, never speak of it again.'" This family of an enemy of the people was exiled to the village of Agul in the Krasnoyarsk district of western Siberia, near an ever-growing complex of forced labor camps. When he was a child, Volkogonov saw long columns of prisoners marching from the rail stations 50 miles away to the camps. Guard dogs, barbed wire, and watchtowers were all part of his childhood landscape. With each passing month, NKVD workers cordoned off more land and built more camps. The guards dug huge trenches in the pine forest and carried the corpses to the trenches at night on old-fashioned Russian sleds. School children would go looking for pine nuts in the forest, and they would hear gunfire, Volkogonov recalled, like the sound of canvas being ripped apart. Volkogonov's mother died just after the end of the war. Like many other orphans, Dmitry Antonovich entered the military as a draftee and never left. His brother and sister were adopted by other families. As a young private and officer during the late 40s and the 50s, Volkogonov got a thorough education in political orthodoxy. He learned quickly that no diversion was too small to be noticed. Toward the end of Triumph and Tragedy, Volkogonov let himself enter the portrait of the system, here as a student of military equipment and state ideology. Students were tested first and foremost for their ability to summarize Stalin's works. "I remember being kept back by a teacher when I was attending the Orel Tank School. He was a lieutenant colonel, no longer a young man, and was very much liked by the class for his good nature. When we were alone, he handed me my work, which was a summary of sources, and said to me in a quiet and fatherly voice, 'It's a good summary. I could see right away you hadn't just copied it down and had given it some thought. But my advice is, summarize the Stalinist works more fully. Understand, more fully. And another thing. In front of the name Yosef Vissarionovich, don't write Com. Write Comrade in full. Got it?' That night, one of my roommates told me they'd all had similar conversations with the teacher of party history. The exams were coming up, and there were rumors that in a neighboring school they had paid attention to the sort of political immaturities I had shown in my summaries. As an officer, Volkogonov was prepared to do anything for the motherland. At a nuclear test site, he was ordered to drive a new model tank straight through the area that had just been the epicenter of an atomic bomb test. And he did. "There was nothing I would not do," Volkogonov told me. "I was a young lieutenant when Stalin died, and I thought the heavens would fall without him. The fact that my father had been shot and my mother died miserably in exile, that didn't seem to matter. It was destiny, incomprehensible. My mind was contaminated. I was incapable of analyzing these things, of putting the pieces together." In the Komsomol and the Communist Party organizations of the Lenin Military Academy in Moscow, Volkogonov became such a master of the standard texts of dogma that he gained a reputation among the senior officers as an especially reliable politrobotnik, a political propagandist. Volkogonov got a doctorate in philosophy, which in those days meant Marxist-Leninist philosophy, and in 1970 was transferred to the Army's Department of Propaganda. There he climbed the ladder steadily. He was promoted to general at 40, won a professorship at 44, and made it to deputy chief in charge of political instruction. Along the way, he also earned a doctorate in history. With his high rank and credentials, Volkogonov was allowed access to all the most important and closed archives in the capital. "But make no mistake about who I was," Volkogonov said. "I was not a closet radical. I cannot distort history to suit my needs. The fact is, I was an orthodox Marxist, an officer who knew his duty. I was not part of some liberal current. All my changes came from within, off on my own. I had access to all kinds of literature. You know, there were many people, especially young officers of the KGB, who thought liberally because they had more information than anyone else. That's why there have always been a lot of thinking people in the KGB, people who understand the West as it really is, and what our own country really was. I was a Stalinist. I contributed to the strengthening of the system that I am now trying to dismantle. But latently, I had my ideas. I began asking myself questions about Lenin. How, if he was such a genius, none of his predictions came true? The proletarian dictatorship never came to be. The principle of class struggle was discredited. Communism was not built in 15 years as he had promised. None of Lenin's major predictions ever came true. I confess it. I used my position. I began gathering information even though I didn't know yet what I would do with it. While working in a KGB archive during the thaw, Volkogonov even read his father's file and learned that what his mother had whispered had been true. Anton Volkogonov had been shot in 1937, just after his arrest. Almost as a dream, Volkogonov decided he would write a trilogy on Stalin, Lenin, and Trotsky. By the late 70s, Volkogonov was secretly working on the Stalin volume. His apartment was crammed with tens of thousands of photocopied documents and books, many of them banned. As time passed and times grew a bit more liberal, Volkogonov made little secret of what he was doing. The military hierarchy, however, decided that Volkogonov's historical research was not consistent with his position as a propagandist. He was shunted aside and installed at the Institute of Military History, a move that represented a demotion, Volkogonov said, of 3 steps down the ladder. For a soldier, perhaps. But for a historian, the demotion was a gift. Now Volkogonov had more time and access to the archives. When the leadership finally came looking for a biography of Stalin, Volkogonov was there, ready to write. Using his position as a general, Volkogonov was able to realize the dreams of such outsiders as Dima Yorosov. Volkogonov's work in the archives not only provided him international fame, it also shattered whatever last illusions he might have had about Soviet history. Now Volkogonov, like so many other intellectuals throughout the Union, saw the roots of catastrophe in the ideology itself, in Leninism. "Abstract ideas give rise to fanatics, and such was Trotsky," he wrote. "The utopianism, the ferocity of Bolshevism, gave rise to the totalitarian state." In the spring of 1991, Volkogonov invited me to meet with him in his hospital room. He was exhausted by his battle with Yazov and the other generals. The hospital was tucked away on a side street off Kalinin Prospect. Compared to other Soviet hospitals I'd seen, with their filthy floors, their crowded rooms, this special clinic for the military elite was a wonder. There were private rooms, wood-paneled hallways, a clean and efficient staff. Volkogonov told me he was ill and not sure how long he had to live. He had stomach cancer and would go for surgery to Western Europe. But he did not seem shocked or sad and wanted only to pick up on what we had talked about in his various offices. You see, I am now convinced that Stalinism created a new type of man. Indifferent, without initiative or enterprise. A person waiting for a messiah. Waiting for someone to come alive and solve all of life's problems. The most awful thing about it is that this cannot merely be shed, like taking off an old raincoat and donning a new one. There are many aspects of this mentality still inside me, and I lose them only slowly. This whole period we are living in now is about scrubbing this mentality from our minds. We are all becoming revolutionaries when it comes to our own individual way of thinking. For you, it is so hard to understand. You are indifferent as to who will be in power in your own country. Democrats or Republicans, America is America. Only some nuances of the system change. For us, a mutiny is going on. The revolution was one sort of mutiny, and we are on the threshold of another. We are making our way through an intellectual and spiritual fog, and all around us is collapse. The generals in the army reproach me for being a chameleon. They say I am a traitor or a renegade. But personally, I think it is a more courageous stance to abandon honestly something which has been devalued by history instead of carrying it to the end in your soul. There are people among them who criticize me in public and in private say I am right, but they can't say so. Now I am in complete isolation. I get support from the grassroots, from junior officers, and a couple of generals even support me secretly. The majority despise me. Even when I meet generals here in the hospital, they pretend not to notice me. Others want to talk to me, but they fear the consequences. These people are frozen in the past. Even truth will not change them. Stalin died physically, but not historically. The image of Stalin lives because it has so many allies. No less than 15% of the letters I get are from Stalinists. And the worse the situation gets, the more of those I get. The party has 16 million people in it. 30% are like Akhramiev or Nina Andreeva. They won't change. Another 30% see the party as a modus vivendi. They can't advance in their careers if they are not members. And the rest could leave at any moment. The army and the KGB were never for real perestroika. They were for minor repairs of the system, a little camouflage. They wanted to preserve the system intact by getting rid of the most obviously odious features, super-bureaucracy, corruption, and so on. Yet none of them wants to question the essence of the system. The party ought to be in control, they say. Totalitarian systems usually absorb people absolutely. As I have come to realize, very few people have been able to transcend such a system, to tear themselves away from it. Most people of my generation will die imprisoned in this system, even if they live another 10 or 20 years. Of course, people who are 20 or 30 are free people. They can liberate themselves from the system quite easily. The only thing I have to offer is my experience. Maybe my example will be valuable in tracing the crisis, the tragedy, and the drama of communist ideas and utopia played out over the generations. Volkogonov was getting tired, and at the same time his mood was changing. The full weight of the news he had just gotten was beginning to hit him, and he began to talk about working at full speed to finish the volumes on Lenin and Trotsky, and perhaps write a memoir. When we got to talking about the dark mood in Moscow, I finally asked him what he thought was ahead. "Democratization is irreversible on the historic, strategic scale," Volkogonov said. "But on the tactical plane, in the short run, the right-wing forces still have a chance. They may even come to the head of the country and hustle us all back into the barn for another 5 or 10 years. They could try. They are that crazy and that angry." Chapter 27. Citizens. Yaganovsko. In the summer of 1989, when the miners brought the revolution to Siberia, Anatoly Shcheglov walked me back from his village to the tram for Kemerovo and invited me back. "I'll take you fishing in the taiga," he said. Now, a year and a half later, the miners were on strike again, and I was back in Siberian coal country. Most of the government's promises had been broken, and conditions were as dismal as ever. Along the road to Shcheglov's hut on 2nd Plan Street, the snow was crusted black. The air was cold and gassy. Anatoly Shcheglov had no phone. I just assumed he'd be at home. When he opened the door, he greeted me as if I'd been away a week, and coming back to Yaganovsko were the most ordinary thing in the world for an American. He looked cleaner, more relaxed, but a good deal older. A lacework of wrinkles ate deep into his face. "I'm retired now," he said. "The expected happened." He said that the winter after we'd met, as he settled his huge frame into a chair one night after dinner, he had a heart attack. "Like a horse kicking him in the chest," he said. He was 50 years old. "It's the usual thing for us underground men," Anatoly said. "You quit at 50, and you're lucky to make it to 55. I doubt if I'll be around much longer." Shcheglov now spent his days standing in lines at empty village stores, shuttling from one filthy hospital to the next, looking for doctors, aspirin, glycerin pills. "An old man's life," he said. But what brightened him, he said, was the nerve and determination of his fellow miners across the country. The strikes now had nothing to do with the issues of July 1989. "It's not about soap or vacation pay anymore," he said. "The miners wanted nothing less than the resignation of Gorbachev's government and the dismantling of the system of state socialism. There are no more illusions left, no more socialist dreams," Shcheglov said. "The first strikes were for a crust of bread, a cut of meat. We got nothing that was promised us. Life just got worse. Now we know the secret. The system has to go." Since the beginning of March 1991, over 300,000 miners had gone out on strike. The remaining 900,000 miners worked only to avert a complete collapse of the national economy. The strike leaders figured they would gain no supporters if it came to that. Their strategy was measured and effective. In the coming weeks, there were warning strikes by machinists in Leningrad, electricians in Samara, Black Sea dock workers in Odessa. The strikes terrified the Kremlin hardliners. They knew that the radicalization of the workers, the proletariat's evolving consciousness, to borrow from the Marxist phrasebook, could be the finishing blow to a tottering regime. Soviet power seemed able to withstand the demonstrations of urban democracy movements, but the workers had the power to turn the lights out in the Kremlin. And they were not kidding. "No more games," Shcheglov said. "No more games." At a session of the Russian Republic's legislature, most of the deputies did little more than echo softly Yeltsin's latest demands for Gorbachev's resignation. But late in the session, the Kuzbass strike leader, Anatoly Malykin, took the floor and announced, "We are prepared to flood the mines." The miners, he said, had lost all tolerance for the system that had bled them white. "Lead the attack," he told the Russian deputies, "or the miners will." A few days after the speech, I met Anatoly Malykin at the Rossiya Hotel in Moscow. There were remnants everywhere of late-night strategy sessions, leaflets, stuffed ashtrays, and dirty glasses. Strike headquarters was wherever Anatoly Malykin happened to be. His phone rang incessantly. Strike committees from Siberia, Ukraine, the Far East, and Vorkuta in northern Russia called with congratulations, questions, advice, more plans. "Well then, fuck 'em," he said at one point on the line to the Kuzbass. "We'll go back when the demands are met, not sooner." Malykin showed more certainty, more sense of purpose, than any of the liberal intellectuals in Moscow and Leningrad. He was absolutely serious. There was no theater in him, no veneer of irony. He and the other strike leaders had taken Gorbachev at his word when they negotiated a settlement to the strikes in 1989. And they would not repeat the mistake. Simple as that. No one is belittling what Gorbachev has already done, but every person has his moment of peak operation, like a machine, Malykin said. But Gorbachev thinks he is unique. At the beginning, he really did do a lot, and we take our hats off to him. But he should have changed the system radically a year or more ago. Then he could have found himself a place for himself in that new structure. But he didn't. He was stuck with his socialist principles. Now he is doing more harm than good. If Gorbachev is so smart, why is he still trying to protect the party? There is a rumor that he is getting ready to send army troops to the mines. Well, believe me, if he does that, the soldiers will die there by the thousands. Novocherkassk. No one knew where the dead were buried. There were rumors. The KGB had pushed the corpses down a mine shaft or into a swamp, or the police had brought the bodies to a series of unmarked graves in cemeteries spread across the black earth zone of southern Russia. But no one knew. For nearly 30 years, the story of the Novocherkassk rebellion was a secret of the state. The strike in June 1962 over price rises and wage cuts at the city's electric locomotive works was the first workers' uprising in Russia since the fitful years immediately after the revolution. At Moscow's orders, the military turned its machine guns on the unarmed demonstrators in Novocherkassk. At least 24 were killed, dozens more injured. Not long after, the Kremlin's judges ordered the execution of 7 ringleaders who had survived. Within 3 days, all mention of Novocherkassk disappeared from the state-controlled press. Even Western specialists knew almost nothing of the bloody affair. Solzhenitsyn published a few pages of rough description in the third volume of the Gulag Archipelago, but that, of course, was considered anti-Soviet propaganda and banned until 1990. Now, with the miners on strike once more, with the KGB, the army, and Gorbachev himself feeling threatened by nationalists and political opponents, in a time of increasing food shortages and ethnic division, there was constant talk of conflict, of civil disobedience, of the possibility of bloodshed. The massacre of demonstrators in Tbilisi, Baku, and Vilnius made it clear that the regime, despite all the reforms, could be expected to bring out the tanks and machine guns, even poisonous gas, if that was what it took to survive. What had changed, if anything, since that summer afternoon in southern Russia in 1962? In addition to the 24 people killed in Novocherkassk, the massacre claimed at least one more victim, Soviet Army General Matvey Shaposhnikov, a true believer in the Bolshevik ideal who was awarded the title of Hero of the Soviet Union after leading a tank division to victory in some of the bloodiest fighting in World War II. Years before the emergence of Sakharov and the dissident movement, Shaposhnikov had done the unthinkable. Ordered to attack the demonstrators at Novocherkassk, he refused. When I met him, the general was 84 years old. His political superiors forced him to retire 3 years after the Novocherkassk massacre. But he was active and strong. With his grip, he could have crushed a walnut. His apartment in the city of Rostov-on-Don, which he shared with his daughter and son-in-law and their children, was military neat, his books and memorabilia perfectly arranged and dusted. "Let's talk face to face," Shaposhnikov said, lifting a heavy chair and setting it down for his guest. He was older than the regime. "I remember clearly singing revolutionary songs as an 11-year-old boy in 1917. Oh, march, march forward, working people! I believed all my life in Soviet power. And now I was being told to shoot at my own people, unarmed people. I had to pay for my decision with everything. They stripped me of my rank, my decorations, my membership in the Communist Party. They told me to retire for health reasons. And my wife, my dear, dear wife, finally paid for it even more deeply. She died a few years ago, and I am convinced she died from the attacks on us. Finally, she just could not bear it. There was not 1 hour, even now, the general said, when he did not think back to the days of the massacre. On the morning of June 1, 1962, the Communist Party press in Novocherkassk announced that the prices of meat and butter would go up at least 25%. When workers at the electric locomotive works arrived at the plant, they discovered that their wages would be cut by as much as 30%. Both local newspapers, The Hammer and The Banner of the Commune, assured the people that these were merely temporary measures, all in the name of social progress. Somehow the workers were not prepared this time to believe the usual doublespeak. Their anger was so intense that they forgot themselves. They forgot for a moment their party discipline and confronted the plant director, an odious bureaucrat named Kurochkin. How would they live now? The workers demanded. You're used to wolfing down meat pies, Kurochkin replied. Now you can stuff them with jam instead. The workers were enraged. They blew the shop floor whistles and started gathering in the courtyards. There they talked of a strike and drew up placards. Give us meat and butter. We need places to live. They ripped down portraits of Khrushchev and burned them. Terrified, the plant managers locked themselves in their offices. The local Communist Party officials refused to meet with any of the strike representatives. Meanwhile, the regional military command had been on alert for weeks in anticipation of the announcement of price hikes and wage cuts. According to Shaposhnikov, the regional military commander, General Isa Pliev, received a stream of coded orders from the Ministry of Defense and Khrushchev himself. That first night, KGB officers and police arrested some of the most outspoken factory workers in an attempt to head off a potential strike. Two members of Khrushchev's inner political circle, Anastas Mikoyan and Frol Kozlov, were already in the city. Shaposhnikov, who had been put in charge of the armed detachments stationed near the locomotive factory, told the two Politburo members that he was gravely concerned that the troops were carrying guns. A confrontation, he said, could lead to bloodshed. Commander Pliev has been given all the instructions he needs, Kozlov replied angrily. On the morning of June 2nd, at around 11 o'clock, 7,000 workers and other demonstrators began their protest march from the locomotive plant to the center of Novocherkassk. They ignored the troops and tanks that surrounded the plant. As they marched, some workers tried to block the railway line leading into town as a further show of protest. But people were unarmed, peaceful. They even carried portraits of Lenin, said Vladimir Fomin, one of the region's deputies in the Russian parliament. The greatest offense of the marchers was their willingness to question Moscow. Khrushchev for sausage meat, the protesters chanted. Anticipating violence, Shaposhnikov told all his soldiers to empty the ammunition from their guns and for the tank brigades to do the same. As the column of demonstrators passed, Shaposhnikov stopped one worker and asked where they were going. Comrade General, the worker said, if the mountain will not come to Muhammad, then Muhammad will go to the mountain. They were headed for the police station and Communist Party headquarters. Shaposhnikov radioed ahead to Pliev and told him that the column of protesters was now moving across the Tuzlov Bridge and into town. Stop them! Don't let them pass! Pliev shouted into his radio. I haven't got enough men to stop 7,000 people, Shaposhnikov said. Send the tanks! Attack them! Leif said. Shaposhnikov said, "Comrade Commander, I see no enemy that our tanks ought to attack." Pliev slammed down the receiver in a rage. In that moment of dead air, Shaposhnikov sensed disaster. But he thought he might be able to head it off. He jumped in a jeep and tried to catch up with the protesters. But by the time he neared the city's central square, the marchers were at the gates of the police station, demanding that the strike leaders be let out of jail. Suddenly, soldiers started firing into the crowd. Some witnesses said the troops were issued dum-dum bullets, which expand on impact. In a panic, the crowd turned and started to flee up Moskovskaya Street. The troops continued firing at their backs. One woman lay in a flower bed, bleeding to death. Her arm had been shot off. By the time the crowd was gone, Solzhenitsyn wrote, the soldiers looked around for trucks and buses, commandeered them, loaded them with the dead and wounded, and took them to the high-walled military hospital. For a day or two afterward, these buses went around town with blood-stained seats. News of the killings spread to other factories. Workers left the plants and staged an even bigger rally in the center of town. Trucks full of workers arrived from everywhere, one witness recalled. It was a torrent of human bodies. No force on earth could have stopped them. "Khrushchev! Khrushchev! Let him see!" the crowd chanted. Soon Mikoyan was on the radio. He spoke of hooligans and the tragic accident. The police issued a curfew order and sent the crowd home. The army left its troops and tanks in the city for weeks. Within 2 days, the official press ceased all mention of the Novocherkassk affair. And so it stayed for decades. General Shaposhnikov was a loyal party member with memories of the first days of the revolution. He could not understand why the local communists had not simply met with the workers as comrades and negotiated with them. He thought that he should write a letter to the Central Committee of the Communist Party. Maybe they would understand. After all, he thought, the Soviet army simply did not attack its own people. You could read it in Lenin, in all the party rule books. He remembered how the party always referred to Bloody Sunday when the Tsarist police in 1905 attacked a crowd of peaceful petitioners. The party and its army would never act that way. Shaposhnikov asked to speak with the party officials. He was refused. Even after a few months went by, the general could not let the killings pass. He began sending anonymous letters to the Soviet Writers' Union in Moscow, in the naive hope that their great humanism would be of help to him. And so Shaposhnikov, a hero of the Soviet Union in his 60s, wrote, "The party has turned into a car which is steered by a reckless, drunken driver who is always breaking the traffic rules. It's high time to take away the driver's license and prevent a catastrophe. Today it is extremely important that the working people and the intellectuals should see clearly the essence of the political regime under which we live. They must realize that we are under the rule of the worst form of autocracy which rests on an enormous bureaucracy and an armed force. It is necessary that people learn to think. Our blind faith is turning us into mere living machines. Our people have been deprived of all political and international rights." Once more, Shaposhnikov's idealism was betrayed. The Writers' Union was a hopelessly corrupt organization, a swamp of toadies, and its officers turned Shaposhnikov's letters over to the KGB. Shaposhnikov said his intentions were never anti-Soviet, but rather anti the bureaucrats and their arrogance. Somehow the KGB did not see it that way. The general began noticing that his mail was arriving already opened. He soon confirmed that he was under surveillance. In 1966, with no explanation, the army forced him out of active duty. In 1967, police searched his apartment and confiscated his archives. Without even pretending to secrecy, they also installed a listening device in the bedroom wall. I was basically under house arrest, and I was followed by men in dark glasses all the time, Shaposhnikov said. There was nothing I could do. Some friends remained loyal, but it was very hard for them, especially in a provincial place like this. They saw what was happening. People tried to avoid me. They would actually cross the street just to avoid saying hello to me in town. Finally, the KGB called Shaposhnikov to local headquarters for a prolonged interrogation. Over and over they demanded that he confess to anti-Soviet activities, and Shaposhnikov always described his work in the countryside teaching illiterate workers to read, his work in the mines for 20 kopecks a shift, his long and celebrated career in the army. How could I have been anti-Soviet when I gave Soviet power everything, he said. If anyone had been dedicated to building communism, it was me. He was stripped of his army rank and his membership in the Communist Party. Only by writing an impassioned letter to the KGB chief, Yuri Andropov, did Shaposhnikov save himself from jail. Through the Brezhnev, Andropov, and Chernenko years, there was not much for the general to do except live in shabby retirement. While other Soviet generals had generous benefits, dachas, special food orders, generous pensions, Shaposhnikov lived no better than a retired factory worker. To pass the time and make a few extra rubles, he wrote memoirs of the war, about the tank assaults on the Nazis on the Ukrainian front. The books were published, but of course they had nothing to do with the massacre at Novocherkassk. Throughout the 60s and 70s, the general never connected with the underground political ferment in Moscow and Leningrad. The truth was, the dissident movement confused him. It seemed directed not only at the leadership, but also at the foundations of Leninist ideology. I could never understand that, he said. When Gorbachev came to power in 1985, Shaposhnikov wrote 5 letters to the Kremlin. They all went unanswered. Finally, in 1988, he got an imperious letter from the Supreme Court. Your case has now been dismissed in view of the absence of corpus delicti. The acts perpetrated by you in the 60s provided ample grounds for bringing charges of anti-Soviet propaganda against you. It is only in the context of perestroika and the democratization of all spheres of life in the Soviet Union that it has become possible to find you not guilty. It would be hard to find a more egregious example of indirection and self-righteousness in the service of simple justice. But Shaposhnikov was only relieved. He began going once more to his local party meetings. I am 60 years a communist, but his faith is of a certain kind. In 1990, when a group of young officers in the army scandalized the generals by forming the reformist group called SHIELD, they made Shaposhnikov their honorary chairman. They even asked him to speak at a huge anti-government rally in Moscow just as troops were killing Azerbaijanis on the streets of Baku. I thought a long time about what I wanted to say that day, Shaposhnikov said. I thought about that afternoon in Novocherkassk and everything that is going on now. And so I said the army has to vow that they are always with the people and not against them. We can never shoot at our own people. Otherwise we are nothing. Otherwise we have no future. We'd better remember that. Moscow. Even after Bloody Sunday in Vilnius, the hardliners wanted still more blood. They wanted to provoke a confrontation with the opposition forces that would require force. They wanted an incident so ugly that they would finally have the pretense they needed to step in, declare a state of emergency, and put an end to the strikes and the defiant leadership in the Baltic states, Moldavia, Georgia, Armenia, and most of all Russia. Gorbachev was showing no signs of relaxing his position. In early March 1991, he proclaimed victory in a referendum to preserve the Union, but he knew well that he had been trumped by Yeltsin. Yeltsin added a second question to the ballot, asking voters of the Russian Republic if they wanted direct elections for a Russian president. They voted overwhelmingly for a June election. Until now, Yeltsin had been the Russian leader, but only because he had been elected chairman of the Republican Parliament, and then only by a narrow margin. But Yeltsin knew two things. First, that he would run and win. Second, that such a victory would force Gorbachev, who had never been elected to anything by the people, to deal more seriously with the opposition. But for now, as president of the country and general secretary of the party, Gorbachev still thought his power was within the party, the KGB, and the military. He listened to them almost unquestioningly, even to their wildest deceptions. Shevardnadze, whose instincts and judgments had proved uncanny since the day of his resignation speech, saw in his friend Gorbachev a man who was a prisoner of his own nature, his conceptions, and his way of thinking and acting. All through 1991, Shevardnadze wrote in his memoir, it was none other than Gorbachev himself who had been spoon-feeding the junta with his indecisiveness, his inclination to back and fill, his fellow traveling, his poor judgment of people, his indifference toward his true allies, his distrust of the democratic forces, and his disbelief in the bulwark whose name is the people. The very same people who had changed thanks to the perestroika he had begun. That is the enormous tragedy of Mikhail Gorbachev. And no matter how much I empathize with him, I cannot help but say that it almost led to a national tragedy. Yakovlev told me that Gorbachev believed the chiefs of the KGB and the Interior Ministry Police when they informed him that the reformers were actually planning to storm the Kremlin walls using hooks and ladders. To tighten the screw, Pravda's deputy editor, Anatoly Karpachev, repeated the same rumors in print, writing that the radicals were making preparations for the final storming of the Kremlin. Yakovlev exploded, telling Gorbachev that these so-called intelligence reports were sheer nonsense, and that he was making a fatal error in listening to all the sycophants and double dealers around him. But Gorbachev was sure he knew better. You exaggerate, he told Yakovlev. Against Yakovlev's advice, Gorbachev ordered a ban on demonstrations in Moscow from March 26th to April 15th, and gave Boris Pugo's Interior Ministry control of the Moscow police force, taking it out of the hands of the liberals who ran City Hall. Gorbachev authorized all law enforcement bodies to use all necessary measures to ensure appropriate public order in the capital. The battle had reached a point of no return. Yeltsin called a demonstration for March 28th. In his own legislature, he was facing a vote of no confidence from the Orthodox Communist deputies. In February, Yeltsin had gone on television blaming Gorbachev for driving the country to the edge of the abyss and for flirting with military dictatorship. Gorbachev, he said, had to step down and power must be transferred to the collective rule of the Republican leaders. By March 27th, the center of Moscow looked like an armed camp. Like the czars who once kept a cavalry unit stabled near Red Square in case of an uprising by university students, the Soviet police meant to deny the center of the capital to the pro-democracy demonstrators. More than 50,000 Interior Ministry troops positioned water cannons and tear gas launchers along the streets. Row after row of empty buses and troops cut off all access roads to Manej Square outside the Kremlin. The hardline press and TASS ran ominous warnings, including the threat to use all means at our disposal from the KGB chief of Moscow, Vitali Prilukov. Democratic Russia's leaders realized that they would never get to the Manej, where they had held so many rallies before. But they did not call off the demonstration. Instead, they said, people should gather at two alternative spots, the Arbat metro station and Mayakovsky Square near the Tchaikovsky Concert Hall. On the morning of the 28th, I walked with my friends Masha and Seryozha to the statue of Mayakovsky. We were more than an hour early, and while we waited to meet some other friends, we saw people selling pro-Yeltsin and anti-Gorbachev buttons. Others listened to the new pro-opposition radio station, Echo of Moscow, which was describing the troop positions along Gorky Street and all around the Manege. Like the Chinese demonstrators at Tiananmen Square in 1989, the demonstrators were going out of their way to seem casual, as if pretending that the worst could never happen. A bunch of teenagers were taking the afternoon as a tusovka, a hangout, and they were listening to a tape of Exile on Main Street on their boombox. For once, Mick Jagger's voice of threat seemed like more than puffed-up theater. As more and more people crowded onto the square, I was getting jumpy. What could prevent these generals from picking a fight? They had made a mess of their coup in Vilnius, it was true, but the KGB still had the means to provoke a conflict, to make it seem as if the demonstrators were out of control, and then restore order. It hadn't been many weeks before that I was talking to General Boris Gromov, the last Soviet commander in Afghanistan, and now Pugo's deputy, and he was telling me that one can stand back and be polite for only so long, but sooner or later you have to take action. Not long before that, I interviewed 15 generals and admirals at the Congress of People's Deputies one afternoon, and all 15 said they thought Viktor Alksnis, the Black Colonel, had the right idea. The demonstration began. The usual speakers, Afanasyev, Popov, spoke. There were the usual banners, CPSU to the ash heap of history, and the usual chants. We marched a little this way, a little that way, but mostly we stood still. The simple fact that so many people had ignored the threat of violence was demonstration enough. We heard from other marchers, and even from an American senator who happened to be there, David Boren of Oklahoma, that plainclothes police, probably KGB, had punched and beaten a few demonstrators who had ventured too close to the armed cordon near the Manege. But the incidents were few. The demonstrations turned out to be boring, blissfully boring. On the face of it, the day had been a political draw. The soldiers held their ground, and the demonstrators marched in defiance of Gorbachev's order and avoided any serious provocations. But in this case, victory belonged to the opposition. The whole stew of opposition forces, urban intellectuals, teenagers, pro-independence people from the republics, proved that they were willing to face down a threat with their bodies as well as their slogans. As we walked home, my friends and I noticed that the crowd was full of itself. They were celebrating a great victory. If the attack on the Lithuanian television tower was the rehearsal for a coup, the protection of the Lithuanian parliament and now this demonstration were rehearsals for the resistance. The resistance looked far more impressive. How could the KGB ignore that? What's more, how could Gorbachev? Magadan. For the first time in their 1,000-year history, Russians were about to elect a president. In those last days of the old regime, in the last few days of the June 1991 campaign, I went to the farthest shore of the empire, to Magadan, where Stalin's slave ships docked and the labor camps of Kolyma began. I had never seen a city so desolate. In the days of the Great Purge, and for years after, prisoners called the rest of the country the mainland, as if Magadan and the wastes of Kolyma beyond were an island in the sea of nowhere. Even now it seemed to me a ghostly place, a landscape of the dead. Mornings the water was the color of iron, the sky the color of milk. The black-green hills were shrouded in a dense mist, and long wisps of smoke trailed into the sky from the tin shack slums known as Shanghai. Even in the center of town, the loudest sound was from the desultory passing of beat-up cars, Ladas, Volgas, and Jigulis, their tires smearing the slush. I was also here to visit my friend Arnold Yeryomenko. We'd first met in Moscow during the 19th Party Conference in 1988, and we saw each other whenever he returned to the capital. I sent a telegram to Arnold telling him I was on the way, but I knew he'd never get it. He was still a marked man in his hometown. The party press in Magadan wrote denunciations of him, as if he held it in his power to topple the regime and steal all its daughters. He was still the anti-Soviet devil. After the 9-hour flight, I walked to Arnold's building and stuck a note under the door telling him where he could find me. The building was appalling. The concrete looked wet and ancient all at once, and the yard outside was a sea of mud and abandoned construction junk. Kids had nothing at all to play with. They threw rocks against a wall, and when they tired, they just sat down on a thick stick stretched across a sheet of abandoned concrete. The next morning, Arnold found me at the Hotel Magadan. We took a long walk to the sea, and then headed back up the hill, the same path the prisoners took 50 years ago. "You see where that ship is now," he said, pointing down a hill into the port. That was where the lines of prisoners began their march from the sea to the holding camps. Many of them would be marched hundreds of miles to camps throughout Kolyma. Arnold said, "Our house was 50 meters from a labor camp. Now it's a movie theater. I could see them from my room, from the kitchen. None of it was ever out of my sight. And it went on from the time I was a baby until I was a young man. And I remember every day in school we ran to the windows and watched the prisoners go by in their chains. The Russians, later the Japanese POWs, and the Vlasovites. I remember we'd come up to them and one might say, 'Boy, go get me some fish.' And he'd slip us a few rubles to buy it. But everyone knew they'd soon be dead. Getting them fish, it was like some horrible joke." Magadan really was the history.